Say good evening, and thank you for coming out for the last Wednesday evening. The next to the last Wednesday evening of our practice period, except that next week many of us will be out in Maple Ridge at Loon Lake Retreat Center. And I hope those of you who won't be there will come and support the practice here, because there'll be practice here as well. So over these past 5 or 6 weeks of practice period, we've been traveling somewhat erratically through the centuries of Zen in China. Mostly in chronological order, but not strictly. And we visited some of the key figures who shaped the Zen that eventually made its way through Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and to us here in the West. We started with Bodhidharma, arriving from India around the beginning of the 7th century. And then the first few generations of Chan or Zen before it was really even Chan. And then into the Tang Dynasty, the so-called Golden Age. And we've seen how Zen monks survived political and social chaos and government persecution by establishing monasteries in the mountains and doing the manual labor to take care of the monasteries and feed the community. And how a kind of dynamic face-to-face interaction developed as a way of practice and teaching in community, and how these dialogues and stories of those times were passed down orally first, and often generations later were written down and collected into books and then added to with commentaries and verses. And these became the koan collections that we know today. And there are others that haven't even been translated into English. A few have been, but the main ones that we're familiar with are not the only ones, but they're the ones that were most revered. And then how those phrases and questions from those old stories came to be used as objects of meditation, particularly in the Rinzai school. Which was also around the time, towards the end of the Tang Dynasty, that the sources of new texts from India, northern India, areas that now are Afghanistan, those sources were drying up, because those areas were being taken over by Islam, and Buddhism was suppressed. So this Chinese literature of Zen arose, along with technologies of printing, woodblock printing, so that it could be an increase in literacy. So there became an educated class. They were called the literati, who worked in government and became students of Zen masters, quite serious students of Zen masters in those days. And from early on, you may have noticed, there have been Zen masters who had a very dramatic and forceful style of teaching, yelling and hitting and using strange phrases to kind of jolt their students out of their ruts of habit patterns, and dualistic thinking. And then there were others who taught in more subtle and gradual ways, just sort of steadily prodding their students to question their assumptions and to practice steadily letting go of attachment, even to achieving enlightenment. So back in the 8th century, there were Mazu and Sherto. We talked about them a few weeks back. And in the 9th century, there were Linji and Dongshan, who then became known as the founders of Rinzai and Soto Zen. But today I want to talk about another pair who were contemporaries in the 12th century. So we're backing up slightly from this past Sunday when Susan talked about Dogen and his teacher Rujing in the 13th century. We're backing up 100 years. So we're going to talk about Dahui and Hongzhir, who had very different styles, but who were friends and deeply respected each other. So I want to tell you a little bit about their lives first before we sample their words. Dahui, in his early years as a monk, practiced in three different schools of Zen. There were five main schools at that time, so he practiced with the Saodong or Soto school, and then the Yunmen. Michael talked about Yunmen a few weeks ago, and the Linji school. So the monks used to travel around a lot. And then he finally settled with his teacher Yuanwu, which was yet a different Rinzai lineage. And Yuanwu was famous because of his commentaries on a collection of koans that was first compiled by a master named Shuedo, which we know in English as the Blue Cliff Record. So that was probably the first big significant collection of koans. And Dahui practiced with Yuanwu for 12 years. And during that time, he would have met a young monk about his own age named Hongzhir, who practiced there for a while as he traveled around from monastery to monastery to various Zen masters, as was the custom. While Dahui was still in his 30s, he was recognized as a kind of rising star in the Zen world. But at that time, the northern Song dynasty was collapsing, and he and his teacher had to flee southwards. The barbarian hordes were taking over in the north. And after his teacher died, Dahui became the abbot of a leading monastery in the south. He became a very popular teacher among, as I said, the literati. These were lay people, and particularly a group of reformers who wanted to restore a government guided by wisdom and virtue. They felt the government had become corrupt. But as does happen, the government suppressed the reformers. Dahui was charged with collusion, was forced to disrobe, and banished to the west of China. During his years of banishment, he maintained an active correspondence but with both his monastic and his lay students. I don't know how the mail got back and forth in those days, but they must have had a way, right? I mean, it was a very organized culture in many ways, of course. So these letters have come down to us. They're quite wonderful. And he also made his own collection of koans with commentaries called The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. Does that title sound familiar? That's what Dogen called his masterwork collection of writings. So he didn't invent that title, did he? Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. I don't know if Dahui's collection and commentaries survived. I need to dig a little deeper to see if I can find that out. I've never seen it or seen any reference to it existing still, but he continued to teach in exile, and he began this practice of using koans, using phrases and questions from the koans as a meditation object for his students. And what I thought was really interesting is that he felt this was a particularly good method for lay students who didn't have hours on end to sit in meditation. It's sort of like a kickstart, he felt, I think, using this pithy question, you know, does a dog have Buddha nature, for example, famous one. Or just, what is this? He was critical of those who approach koans from more of a literary or academic standpoint without engaging them fully as direct experience. He also criticized those who practiced what was called silent illumination, which is the more the Soto practice, which he claimed just teaches people to stop and rest and play dead, sitting wordlessly with eyes shut beneath the black mountain, not seeking subtle, wondrous enlightenment. So he said, don't think, you know, that silent illumination is just sitting there like a lump with an empty mind. Or, you know, nodding off. He lived in harsh times. And I think he felt a strong concern that both the government and Zen had become sloppy and decadent. So his teachings had a kind of urgent edge, I think, to combat complacency. He even went to the extreme of burning the woodblocks of his teacher's Blue Cliff record to prevent it being used wrongly. But fortunately for the rest of the world, other copies survived. For future generations. But they weren't found for close to 200 years, just in time for Dogen to arrive in Japan.
China.
I mean China, from Japan. So we might wonder what he would think of how koans have come to be used, or came to be used in Japan and in the West. Dahui was eventually pardoned because of his work to relieve the suffering of the peasants, the ordinary people, in his place of exile during times of terrible suffering and illness. And eventually he returned to the area where he had originally practiced with Yuanwu many years earlier and accepted a position as abbot at a prominent monastery on the recommendation of his old friend Hongzhir, who was had a monastery nearby. Daihui lived another 6 years and died with receiving great honor. One more thing about Daihui. He was the first Chinese master known to have given full Dharma transmission to women. One laywoman and two women who had been married and then became nuns later in life. And I will tell you more about that in a couple of weeks, because we're going to have a practice period bonus where I want to talk about the women, because you may have noticed that there haven't been any in this whole series. A lot of them didn't become recorded, right? It wasn't until 17th century that Chan women's own writings and teachings became recorded. But there are some in the stories and in the koan records, and I'm going to talk about them in a couple of weeks. Many were anonymous. Old women by the roadside selling tea, getting ready to embarrass monks who are little bit too full of themselves. So on to Hongzhir. He spent most of his years practicing in the Soto school, almost in inverse proportion to Dahui. But his first teacher was named Kumu, which means dead tree, who taught a very rigorous practice, long hours of zazen, which he called Mo Chao, or silent illumination. Meditation without an object, dropping away body and mind. This is what Dogen later called Shikantaza, and it's the kind of core Soto Zen practice. When Hongzhir left Kumu, he traveled for 11 years, and he stopped to practice with the Rinzai master, the same Rinzai master where Dahui was practicing Yuanwu. And he also studied for some time with another Soto master named Tansha, who had made a collection of koans with his own verse comments. And he encouraged Hongzhir, who was a poet, and he encouraged his literary talents. So Hongzhir went on to make two koan collections of his own, with one with verse and one with prose comments, and these became the core of what we know of as the Book of Serenity. A century later, another monk added commentary and created what we know of as the Book of Serenity. Eventually, Hongzhir was asked to take over a small rundown temple on Mount Tiantong in the far east of China, away from the war-torn regions. And the temple grew and attracted students. The legend goes that he did not come down from the mountain for 30 years, until the day before he died, when he came down to thank his patrons and supporters. But he was not disconnected from the wider world. He sent assistance to local villages in times of hardship, and he was, like Dahui, very generous in his teaching of lay people as well as monks. For all Dahui's criticisms of the weaknesses of what he silent illumination, he never directed those criticisms at Hongzhir. And Hongzhir never spoke ill of Dahui's approach to Zen either. And apparently Dahui visited Hongzhir not long before his death, and Hongzhir requested that Dahui take care of his affairs after he died. So I love that these two had such great respect for each other. And when, in a few minutes, you take a look at their teachings, I think that you'll find more common ground than not, even though their approaches were different. Just thought I'd read you Hongzhir's deathbed poem. Sort of a thing in those days that you composed a deathbed verse. Illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years. A white bird vanishes in the mist. Autumn waters merge with the sky. Just seeing the this past week, you know, when it gets these clear, frosty fall mornings. We live out in the Fraser Valley, and the fog rises up from the river valley, and so we come down off our mountain. We live on Blue Mountain, and you see this blanket of fog down in Maple Ridge and over the city. So a white bird vanishes in the mist. Autumn waters merge with the sky. Made me think of right now. After the death of these two great teachers, their differences were exaggerated by later generations and used in sort of sectarian debates. But I think from the writing that they left behind, we can feel a deep resonance that goes beyond the sudden and the gradual, Rinzai and Soto, and that they really shared an essence. although Dahui tried to sabotage the transmission of the Blue Cliff record, it survived. And ironically, according to legend, Dogen, the night before he returned from China to Japan, stayed up all night hand-copying the Blue Cliff record, apparently with the help of some deities who appeared, because there's no way he could have gotten it all done otherwise. And Dogen himself assembled his own selection of 100 koans from the Chinese tradition. And much of his treasury of the True Dharma Eye collection of talks, teachings, are his commentary on those koans. The Book of Serenity, as we know it, wasn't compiled until after Dogen's life, but he was definitely influenced by, and he often referenced, Hongzhi's writings and poetry. So these old Zen masters continue to guide our practice to this day. So I selected some passages from Hongzhi and Dahui for you. And we're not going to go over them in detail. It's more just to give you the flavor of their writing and their teaching, and just see what resonates for you. What I thought we could do is take turns with people just reading a paragraph. And if you want, as they're reading, just if there's something that just catches your attention or resonates, just make a little tick with your pen to come back to it. Okay, so let's start with Dahui. So that is the side of this page that says, from Swampland Flowers, the letters and lectures of Zen Master Dahui, translated by Christopher Cleary. So would someone read the first paragraph? And so read nice and loud and not too fast so people can read along. Okay, Eugenia, and then John, the next paragraph.
People often use the mind which assumes there is something to attain, to seek the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain. What do I mean by the mind which assumes there is something to attain? It's the intellectually clever one, the one that ponders and judges. What do I mean by the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain? It's the imponderable, the incalculable, wherein there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness.
Thank you. Next.
People make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear a person of knowledge speak of the Dharma, in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. Whenever I see someone talking like this, I immediately ask him, is this one who fears falling into emptiness himself empty or not? 10 out of 10 cannot explain. Since you have always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place, as soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, immediately you are at a loss and can't find your grip. You're far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life.
Okay, next paragraph. Somebody? Yeah, Michael.
If correct mindfulness is present at all times and the attitude of fear for birth and death don't waver over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale will naturally become fresh. But what is the stale? It's the brilliance and cleverness, that which thinks and judges. What is the unfamiliar? It's enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, the Buddha nature where there's no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach. where there's no way for you to use your mental arrangements.
Next.
Suddenly the time arrives. You may be on a story of an ancient's entry into the path, or it may be as you are reading the scriptures, or perhaps during your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. Whether your condition is good or not good, or your body and mind are scattered and confused, whether favorable or adverse conditions are present, or whether you have temporarily quieted the mind's conceptual discrimination, when you suddenly topple a key link, there'll be no mistake about it.
Thank you. And the last paragraph, somebody? Yeah, Ben?
The path of mindlessness is easy to seek out. So-called mindlessness is not being inert and unknowing like earth, wood, tile, or stone. It means that the mind is settled and imperturbable when in contact with situations and meeting circumstances. Such a mind does not cling to anything, but is clear in all places, without hindrance or obstruction. Without being stained, yet without dwelling in the stainlessness, this mind views the body and mind like a dream or illusion. Yet without remaining in the perspective of dreams and illusions, empty nothingness. Only when one arrives at a realm like this can it be called true mindlessness. Just get to the root. Don't worry about the branches. Emptying this mind is the root. Once you get the root, the fundamental, then all kinds of language and knowledge and all your daily activities as you respond to people and adapt to circumstances, through so many upsets and downfalls, whether joyous or angry, good or bad, favorable or adverse, these are all trivial matters, the branches. If you can be spontaneously aware and knowing as you are going along with circumstances, then there is neither lack nor excess.
Okay, thank you. I had thought of mixing these all up, different paragraphs, and seeing if you could go see if it's Dahui or Hongzhi, because it's not so easy to tell, despite their seeming contrasts. Okay, so next page is Hongzhi. First paragraph. Anybody different want to read? Yeah, Allison, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah.
From Guidepost of Silent Illumination. The 10,000 forms majestically glisten and expound Dharma. All objects certify it. Every one dialogue. Dialoguing and certifying, they respond appropriately to each other. But if illumination neglects serenity, then aggressiveness appears. Certifying and dialoguing, they respond to each other appropriately. But if serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted Dharma. When silent illumination is fulfilled, the lotus blossoms, the dreamer awakens, 100 streams flow into the ocean, 1,000 ranges face the highest peak.
Thank you. I'm just going to go back to one line there to help you out a little. Silent illumination, I wish I'd checked the Chinese characters for this, but I believe that the silent kind of corresponds to samadhi, stillness, the meditative, the deep concentration, and illumination is the wisdom side. And so notice he says, if illumination neglects serenity, so if wisdom neglects serenity, aggressiveness appears. And if serenity neglects wisdom, in other words, if you're overbalanced on the blank mind side, murkiness leads to wasted Dharma. So right there, he's making clear what silent illumination practice means to him. Okay, ever onward. Next long paragraph, somebody? Michael, why don't you read it?
Okay. In the great rest and great halting, the lips become moldy and mountains of grass grow on your tongue. Moving straight ahead beyond this state, totally let go, washed clean and ground to a fine polish. respond with brilliant light to such unfathomable depths as the waters of autumn or the moon stamped in the sky. Then you must know there is a path on which to turn yourself around. When you do turn yourself around, you have no different face that can be recognized. Even if you do not recognize your face, still nothing can hide it. It is penetrating from the topmost all the way down to the bottom. When you have thoroughly investigated your roots back to their ultimate source, 1,000 or 10,000 sages are no more than footprints on the trail. In wonder, return to the journey. Avail yourself of the path and walk ahead. In light there is darkness. There it operates. Where it operates, no trace remains. With 100 grass tips in the busy marketplace, graciously share yourself. Wide open and accessible, walking along, casually mount the sounds and straddle the colors, while you transcend listening and surpass watching. Perfectly unifying in this manner is simply a patched-robed monk's appropriate activity. Phew.
Okay, next one. Luis.
Okay.
Oops.
All beings are your ancestors. Fully appreciate the emptiness of all dharmas. Then all minds are free and all dusts evaporate in the original brilliance shining everywhere. Transforming according to circumstances, meet all beings as your ancestors. Subtly illuminate all conditions, magnanimous beyond all duality. Clear and desireless, the wind in the pines and the moon in the water are content in their elements. Without minds interacting, wind and pines, or moon and water, do not impede one another. Essentially, you exist inside emptiness and have the capacity to respond outwardly without being annoyed, like spring blossoming, like a mirror reflecting forms. Amid all the noise, spontaneously emerge transcendent.
Thank you. And last paragraph, Luke.
The person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountain appears. The moon sets and the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. Every dust is whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and engage the world with energy. There's an excellent saying that the six sense doors are not veiled. The highways in all directions have no footprints. Always arriving everywhere without being confused, gentle without hesitation, the perfected person knows where to go.
Great, thank you. So I think you could probably find some lines in there, I know I do, that I could print out and post, you know, and repeat almost as a koan, you know, little touchstone, reminder, wake up, pay attention. Yeah, some really great lines in there. And so what I'd like you to do is clump up in your groups. You might need to just move in your groups first, and then just take a couple minutes to look back over, take your pens and mark, and just find a couple of spots that you feel you could, you know, share with the other people in your group that resonate for you. What do those words mean to you? Just pick one or two spots. Okay? So group up in groups of three, like we usually do.
From both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you don't have to exhaustively go through this. Just find a couple of things that you can share with each other. Okay, so move together. Find your groups first, and then just take a minute or so to review before I ring the bell. I think there's a sense that we get. Can you want one more over there? Okay, Michael can join. Pass me the inking.
You pack the inking, but there's the bell.
Oh, just any bell. Doesn't have to be the inking. Yeah. Yeah, so take just a minute or two and review, and then I'll ring the bell and the first person can go. Do you have a pen? No. Borrow somebody else. Depending on where they are. Do you need one? Do you need one? There's two pages. Oh. They're back to back.